You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 265, and I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On the program this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with longtime community organizer and researcher Fred Burrill. Fred talks about the history of anti-gentrification struggles and housing justice organizing in the St. Henri district of Montreal. I feel this interview is important because it looks at the ways that community organizing takes place over time, and particularly looks at how the financialization of housing has impacted a particular neighborhood in a key North American city, Montreal, and how local residents have been organizing and trying to push back against this financialization of housing that has led to such devastating both rent increases and also people being pushed out of their historical working class neighborhoods. I think this is an important window into somebody that has spent a lot of time both organizing and also thinking critically about these intersections. So here is my conversation with Fred Burrill for Free City Radio. Housing crisis is a term that we are hearing in media reports and also off the lips of politicians at a scale that I at least it seems to me is unprecedented. That same term could be used to describe the scale of the crisis. Responding to this, we've seen a whole wave of different sort of policy proposals. Even the Conservative Party of Canada is talking about the housing crisis. Often missing in this discussion is sort of an understanding of what social movement responses to the housing crisis look like, and also, just on a basic level, why not just non-market housing is important, but social housing. And this brings in a larger sort of critique of how the commodification of housing brought us to this point of crisis. Fred Burrill, you're an educator, a researcher. You have also worked for many years in the Southwest with a housing committee, PAPIR, which is a member of FRAPU in Quebec. We'll share links about those two organizations in the show notes for those people outside of Quebec who don't know about that. Maybe you could first introduce yourself and respond to anything that was just brought up that you feel maybe are important essential points of context for people to just get a grounding sense of understanding about what's happening.
Sure. Okay. So as you said, I'm a teacher and an organizer around housing justice stuff. I worked for many years at the Paupières Comité Logement in Saint-Henri in the southwest of Montreal. And listening to you kind of just give the little preface about the housing crisis and it being unprecedented, of course it is. The proportions of the disaster that the urban tenants are facing across Canada right now and in Montreal are unprecedented. But a housing crisis, in fact, is not. In St. Henri, anyway, in the southwest of the city, you probably remember because you were active around this time, late 90s, early 2000s. Moving day, July 1st in the year 2000, there were families sleeping in the gym of the high school, right? Because there were simply not enough places for them to go, and so this systematic sort of washing its hands of its responsibility for ensuring the right to housing by the state, which has its roots in the neoliberal turn basically from the mid 70s onward in Quebec, by the turn of the 21st century had resulted in total breakdown of the society's ability to ensure that the vast majority of its population was able to sleep inside, right? And this has continued to expand this crisis. I would say maybe in the last 10 years, it's been a little bit under the radar because When we talk about housing crisis, mm-hmm. we talk about, you know, the vacancy rate mm-hmm. being under 3%. And so the vacancy rate in general has been a little bit, has been around 3%, a little bit higher than 3%. But what this is hidden is that, in fact, that vacancy rate was bumped up by the construction of condos that were then being rented out, which, of course, is inaccessible to anybody on a middle-income household, right? And so now this sort of subterranean housing crisis that has been building over the last decade mm-hmm. has exploded out into the public view. So, yeah, it's really drastic, and it's indicative of the systematic underinvestment in the construction of social housing, mm-hmm. Social housing both geared to income mm-hmm. And in general, you know, not non-market, because I think you're still participating in the housing market, but, you know, basically off-market housing alternatives and that investment by the state and you know, that kind of the broader economic switch from industrial production to a financialized model in the global north, in which, you know, the profit making model in North American capitalism is almost entirely based mm-hmm. On speculation, extraction, and mm-hmm. household income debt, right? And so, mm-hmm. This entails the, you know, the buying and selling of debt and the relation to shelter as a sort of a speculative good rather than even basic rent seeking, right? So so the people who were the slumlords are now the property developers, right? So the economic model of rent seekers has moved from, you know, making money off of people's monthly need to making money off of selling people's home. And so then people are facing rent evictions, are facing increases in rent based on increasing property value. So this never-ending speculative cycle, which of course careens us into crisis territory, is right off the charts at the moment.
A lot of strands there, and important ones. I just wanted to pick up on one to sort of understand how there are political and economic decisions that have brought us to this place. And I mean, the financialization or the marketization of housing is something that is, I think, starting to be understood a bit. But I think there's still like this populaire, like sort of sense that, well, you know, of course people own homes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and I do think that some people listening to this program probably haven't had a chance to hear somebody who's really taken the time within the context of movements to sort of deconstruct how this situation arrived, right? So maybe if you could highlight one or two points from your perspective that are policy decisions on the part of the powerful that brought us to this crisis and how it's not random.
I mean, the first major one is the decision of the federal government, of course, to cut funding in Canada, funding for social housing, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the kind of was being built up to by the Moroni conservatives in the early 90s. And then that decision was made by Jean Chrétien, the Liberal government, and Paul Martin, the finance minister, in 94. And, you know, there have been successive moves. Quebec is one of the only provinces in Canada that still has a provincial housing program. And there have been successive moves over a variety of neoliberal governments, both Parti Québécois and Liberal, and then the CAQ, to decimate what's left of that housing program to the point where, you know, we still nominally have a program on the books now, but it's basically non-existent. The other kind of main policy, at least in the Montreal context, the other one of the main sort of policy decisions that led to the speculative approach to housing that we have now is the dezoning of industrial property to residential. So this, you know, occurred actually under, to a large extent, the Montreal Citizens Movement, which was the sort of like lefty social democrats 1.0 before Projet Montréal, who held power in the 80s and early 90s, you know, to, in some cases, literally buy up industrial industrial property like the former Stelco plant, the steel plant in Little Burgundy, and then sell it for peanuts to developers as a way to kind of, you know, stimulate the development of something called, you know, like a place like the Lachine Canal, which was a sort of industrial corridor that now is kind of like the heart of Condoland in Montreal. And so across the city, all kinds of property, basically allotments that were zoned industrial, which were places of employment for working class people, were deregulated and were basically sold for dimes on the dollar to property developers. And those property developers were not like sort of, you know, X person wants to build a house and then has a duplex and runs out to the top floor, right? It's a it's massive hedge funds working together, including in Quebec, actually, that one of the main funders of condo construction is the FTQ, the labor union, the Fonds de Solidarité du Québec. So we can see the kind of the moving away from the daily lives of working class people of the labor movement as well, and its sort of reinvestment in speculation. And so these two things, the at the federal provincial level, the disinvestment in the construction of social housing, and at the municipal level, the deregulation of industrial land, you know, I think are two sort of key main policy pieces in the crisis as we see it today.
I see a mirroring in a way when you're just speaking about the sort of deregulation of former industrial zones and the city of Montreal. And this has happened in other cities around the world, just passing it on to quote-unquote developers. People are making a lot of money from this, and there's also not really any process of accountability for these profits. And taking what could be sort of a public infrastructure and passing it to the free market, quote-unquote, which... really does not see a circling back to the needs of tenants and working people. I'm seeing the mirroring with the rhetoric from the conservative opposition as it stands. They're literally talking about just taking Canadian public land, which, you know, there's so many layers of problematic around that as it's occupied Indigenous territory. Mm-hmm. So it even adds another layer of problem here because they're just aiming, from what I understand, to just throw this land at developers with few strings attached, and then that somehow is going to solve the housing crisis. Could you deconstruct this a bit?
Well, I mean, it's not a new approach. I mean, it's pretty much the approach. I mean, here in Montreal, in this period of the Montreal City, or so the Montreal Citizens Movement in the late 1980s, early 1990s, something called Opération 10,000 Logements. So it was a lot of this kind of deregulation of former lands and giving it to developers to deal with basically what, you know, what they saw as the root of a problem in the housing market, which was, you know, shortage of available units. But of course, you know, the big lie of sort of dominant economic rhetoric about the housing crisis is that it's a question of vacancy, which of course it isn't. It's a question about the consolidation of control of the housing stock in the hands of the capitalist class, right? So the rhetoric that says, you know, the problem, you know, it can be in the earlier period, it was, you know, it wasn't so much around immigrants. Now it's, you know, the problem is the problem is immigrants who are taking up all the housing.
That's the rhetoric.
That's the rhetoric. The real issue is the fact that that people own multiple homes. You know, there are all kinds of luxury condos with no one living in them because they're sort of speculative properties. And so, you know, if we think about things in terms of that basic class conflict, then those sort of lines of reasoning, the kind of the bait and switch that sees the problem that people really are in, and then, you know, but blames it on the population that's not responsible for it, becomes easier to kind of track and get a hold of.
Underline a bit more, you use the term bait and switch here to describe that, what you just described.
Yeah.
clarify it a bit, please.
So it's, you know, it kind of it puts out this line that, you know, we are in a housing crisis, which of course, you know, we are. Like, people are, the homeless population or the unhoused population is growing by leaps and bounds, all kinds of hidden forms of homelessness. People are sleeping on friends' couches, yes, et cetera. Yes. It's just even more the case for households with kids, you know, because it's impossible to find apartments in Montreal, at least with, you know, two or three bedrooms, for anything less than $3,000 a month. So it puts out this real problem, which is the bait, right? And then the switch is holding out a population that is not at all responsible for this, which is, in fact, you know, the newcomers to Montreal, as the culprits, and hides the real culprits, who are, you know, landlords and hedge funds and bankers and politicians. Mm.
You mentioned hedge funds. Okay, so I think this is important. You also talked about the Fédération Travail du Québec, the FTQ's use of their hedge fund for sort of speculative property development. Mm-hmm. Talk about this. I know that there's many, many important companies in Quebec that are linked to this. I remember also learning that one of the former textile giants, Lemoore, mm-hmm. in Chabanel, the former garment district in Montreal, has sort of created a spinoff, mm-hmm. that is seeing the quote-unquote redevelopment of former industrial buildings. Talk a bit about hedge funds and these sort of corporate shapes. The shapes, maybe you could just describe the basic shapes of this.
So, you know, this is part of a general trend in the global north, away from sort of the production of commodities to a financialized model in which, you know, basically there is the realization of profit without the production of value. So it's all just kind of moving money around without actually producing anything, and you know, that means like moving it away from poor people, moving it into the pockets of the ultra wealthy, and one of the mechanisms for that is real estate. And so you get big companies like Prével or Devimco or whatever that are privately owned, or that are publicly owned in the sense that they have shareholders, yep. right? And people invest in that, and so there is the kind of socialization amongst the capitalist class broadly of the exploitation of the need to have shelter, right? And so you get these kind of both on the big scale of yep. massive hedge funds that have investors that are kind of collective funds that are then developing or that, in fact, then become landlords themselves that have tenants in many cases. Or on the other hand, you get banks essentially buying and selling individual household debt as shares on the stock market, right? So there is the people invest in debt. So, you know, the middle income household gets a mortgage from the bank, sort of overextending itself in order to buy a condo because maybe, you know, they couldn't afford rent anymore, actually, in a lot of cases. And then that that mortgage that they have becomes a commodity that the bank then sells parts of to other banks, to speculative individual investors, to investment firms. So there is that like second underlying model. And then finally, actually, one thing that we have here a lot in Canada, and there's a really good new book about this by a guy named Tom Fraser, who works for, who's a researcher, union researcher in Toronto, in which major public, mostly retirement funds, become themselves majority investment holders or majority shareholders in investment companies that are landlords. So, you know, the example, the big example in Canada is a firm called Starlight, which owns, you know, like massive tower blocks in Toronto, and the major investment in that is the federal public service pension fund PSP. So it takes the pension funds that public service workers pay into and uses those in order to exploit the monthly needs of other working class people. So it takes a certain segment of working class income and redirects it into the exploitation of other working class people. So it's this whole model in which money is just moved around from one place to another in order to generate profits that aren't based on anything other than the exploitation of need, which then of course lines the pockets of very rich people.
While you were speaking, I was picturing some memories of different marches in the Southwest, and I thought of this. There was a squat action to talk about the housing crisis in the Southwest of Montreal and St. Henry. I was picturing this land occupation that you were involved in, where there was a demand for a vacant lot to be turned into social housing. I'm sure there's layers to that. Mm-hmm. I'm also picturing this march that went up the highway when it was closed, when they demolished blocks of housing for highway infrastructure. There are many layers there in terms of car culture, et cetera. But I remember all these tower blocks, but like 3-4-story Montreal buildings were demolished. And I'm just thinking about a lot of, and there's many, many other actions, and you were involved in this neighborhood. I think often when we hear sort of stories about the housing crisis or even protest movements in relation to the housing crisis, we maybe sort of parse out these sort of stories of like a family that got evicted, and how that's unjust, but it's sort of a heartstrings, very simplistic story. One family fought back and successfully evaded their eviction. But the movements themselves aren't often seen as the ground for thinking about a different world in relation to housing and how the conception of housing is. I think that's something important to you, the idea that in those spaces, as people are organizing, there's important ideas being expressed both in the action, but also in those spaces of protest to think about a different, radically different approach to the housing crisis. I don't know if this speaks to you.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing about the landlord-tenant relationship is that unlike at your job, where you often have coworkers and you sort of see you see that you share this condition of exploitation with the other people that you work with. Being a tenant is a very individualized, often, form of exploitation, right? Because you have an individual contract with the landlord, and we live in a relatively atomized world, and especially with the kind of with the fragmentation of the housing market that exists, people move a lot, so they don't necessarily know their neighbors, right? So it's a building a sense of being a tenant as a class position through struggle, I think, is one of the most important things that we can do at this point. Because as I said, the conditions of precarity that we face as tenants, it's made by policy, it's made by intentional moves of the capitalist class, but it remains a class struggle. It remains the concentration of power amongst the hands of the ruling class. And so therefore, the only way that we can really contest it is through building counterpower, right? And that building that counterpower has to happen through struggle.
And so when you, just to end, you talk about struggle. Maybe just share a bit about what that has looked like for you, because struggle is like a very strong word, but I'm also picturing people like duct taping signs together, or like making a soup to carry it to the protest, or the hot chocolate, or a few different people working on a text to send to the media. I mean, there's all these like very human, cute, hardcore, there's so many layers to that.
Sure. Yeah. It's all of it. I mean, it's So when I say struggle, I mean I mean action in a lot of cases, you know, which has been direct actions and sort of mass mobilizations, but also it is all the kinds of, you know, care and sort of mutual aid and responsibility that go into building a movement. You know, which includes things, as you say, making food, walking people's dogs, hospital visits, all of these things, right? Yeah. That people in our sort of fractured existences often end up kind of dealing with on our own. So it's our responsibility as people in the movement to make sure that as much as possible we're trying to deal with those things together.
You opened up a lot of space for reflection in this conversation, and I hope that also people can sort of visit some of the definitions that you laid out. They're very important, both in relation to the housing crisis, its origins, and the financialization of housing and popular power. Thank you so much for speaking today, Fred.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks.
That was a conversation with Fred Burrill, longtime community organizer and activist. He also has done a lot of research and oral history work about community organizing against gentrification and for housing justice in the St. Henri district in Montreal. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. and on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you soon.